So one way of describing meditation is it's radical acceptance. Tara Brach even has a book called Radical Acceptance. Radical surrender. So radical acceptance and radical surrender, how does that sit with you in the climate we're in socially and politically right now? Might there be some dissonance? So just to go back, the accepting does not prevent action. Buddhism is not passivity-ism. It's supposed to be pacifism, as in pacific, as in peace, not as in passive-ism. It doesn't always live up to the hype. So rather than acceptance be the obstacle to taking action, it's the very foundation from which our wise or skillful action emerges. Because we need the acceptance to have the clear seeing to even know where to intervene. And the clear seeing is free of our projections. It's even free of hope and fear. Clear seeing is just actually clear seeing. So in other words, there's a sky, it's a blue sky, there's a cloud in the blue sky. Clear seeing is just that, blue sky, white cloud. And then all the trouble starts when we say blue sky good, white cloud bad. The clear seeing has stopped. We actually are disconnected from what's happening as soon as we do that. So clear seeing built on acceptance is the foundation of skillful action. And part of clear seeing, we could say one way of approaching this bridge of meditation and action is we have to get clear on the inside and then build out from that. If you can't even be clear on the inside about what is actually inclining you towards your real happiness and what is actually blocking you or taking you away from your real happiness, if you're not clear what that is for you on the inside, how can you hope to then come into the extremely complex situation of the world and think that you can clearly know what's right? Now, so this, I'm not trying to set it up. You have to get fully enlightened before you can have a hope of taking action in the world, because that's obviously, we're going to be waiting a long time. But it's to just be a little bit not so attached to what we think is the right action when we're still kind of in our own delusion. So when we see clearly, either inner or outer, what we find is the world is deeply interrelated. We are related with the natural world, the family world, the school world that your children might be in, the social world, the political world, the cultural world. It's all deeply interconnected. So to really want to do reality well, we have to be able to do relationship well. Not only is the word all related, but we're very social beings. And so a big part of clear seeing is knowing wise relationship. And so from this theme of building on the inside out, how do we put our meditation into action? We build out from our inner clarity. So our inner clarity is actually relationship. Mindfulness is relationship. When we are in mindfulness of our experience, we are in relationship with it. If we're lost in it, we're not in relationship with it. We're actually just off to the races. It's running the show. It's only when we wake up to it that there's actual relationship. Oh, this is happening. I know this is happening. And mindfulness is both wisdom and kindness together. Wise relationship. It's like the Dalai Lama touching foreheads with the child, with delight. There's all the wisdom and intelligence of the Dalai Lama up there. But then there's the kindness and the meeting things with affection. And that's why I love that picture so much. That is wise relationship on the inside. And the very interesting thing is neuroscientists are finding that mindfulness uses the social circuitry of the brain. The very circuitry that gets wired through healthy attachment when you're a child with a primary caretaker, that's the very circuitry that gets used with our mindfulness practice. We learn in, you know, the bonding with our primary caretaker how to relate. And then that circuitry in the brain is what our mindfulness travels through. Isn't that interesting? Mindfulness is relationship. So, and the essence of wise relationship is joining without merging. So to really be in relationship with someone, we need to be empathic, and that's our way of joining. But merging is when you just get totally lost and there isn't a you there. It's not relationship anymore. You've lost the kind of sense of, like, I'm my own being, you're your own being. And so, you know, there's an old cartoon, Nicole Hollander was the cartoonist, I don't remember, but, and I think the character's Nicole, this is from the 80s, but, you know, it's a professional woman, and she comes home, she's inside the door, and the dog and the cat are sitting there, and she said, oh, you're just not going to believe this, the little bubble, you know, they laid me off today. And then the dog is sitting there saying, it's my fault. I was so enthusiastic chasing the stick this morning that, you know, she was late for work, and I'm sure that's why they fired her. You know, that's the golden retriever. And the cat's little bubble is, please, don't share. I'm a cat lover, so I can bash the little kitties, I guess. So both versions, right? The dog's version is the codependent version. The cat's version is just not connected. And you know you're codependent if you fall off a cliff and somebody else's life flashes before your eyes. So mindfulness is neither of those. Mindfulness is connected with the experience, joined with the experience without being merged or overwhelmed by the experience. It's neither dog nor cat. It's this middle clarity. And again, it's a little bit like the Dalai Lama, total acceptance of that child as the child is. But the Dalai Lama knows so much more than that child knows. That's the wisdom. So wisdom and kindness together in mindfulness as wise relationship. So if our world is an interrelated world and we're social animals, our world is primarily a world of relationships. So mindfulness teaches us wise relationship on the inside. So what does it look like if we build that out? So wise action comes from really placing primacy on relationship. So you're in a kerfuffle with somebody and you're both really focused on the kerfuffle and you forget there's a relationship. If you both attend to the relationship with the kerfuffle inside it, it's much easier to deal with a conflict. If you both know you love each other and you're being overt about that, and then you're going to start owning your own stuff and not projecting it out. You know, this is where we start doing effective action. Effective action comes from wise relating, and it comes from putting relationships primary. So this is all about, this can be, you know, like opposing Donald Trump or opposing Hillary if you're not a Hillary supporter. Or it can be just getting your kids off to school. It can be negotiating your relationship, your work relationships. All of it. There's this continuum of action based out of wise relationship. So a Buddhist scholar in our inside world, Andrew Alensky, has this to say, and he wrote this in 2002, right, you know, a year after 9/11 happened. And this is an essay called Healing the Wounds of the World. And he said, many of us in America today are thinking about security, wondering how to best keep our families and our nations safe. What is the Buddhist view of how to achieve safety and security? The Buddha describes how real security comes from cultivating and nurturing the network of social relationships within which each person finds themselves embedded. Caring for, supporting, and respecting one's parents will ensure that they in turn will care for, support, and respect their children. Doing the same for one's wife or husband or partner, teachers and supervisors, friends and colleagues will similarly result in reciprocal response and to the strengthening of the social bond that connects one's whole community. For example, being kind and generous and honest with your spouse is the best protection from the turmoil of divorce and acrimony. Treating your employees fairly and sharing the fruits of their labor equitably is the best way to encourage their loyalty and cooperation. Nurturing your own children with love and devotion is more likely to result in them caring for you when you are eventually in need. How does this basic principle apply to our country in this pivotal period of response to terrorist attack? Our deeper, more lasting security will only come from the gradual transformation of our relationships with people who are currently considered adversaries and who presently wish us harm. Turning enemies into friends is a surer way of protecting ourselves than returning violence with more violence. You might think of this as a really, really difficult time. This is the most peaceful time in the history of the planet. Europe has not been at war with itself since, you know, World War II. There's a lot of really violent, you know, difficult stuff going on. So this is not to say that's not there, but we are making progress slowly. So he goes on to talk about the Soviet Union breaking up and becoming allies and friends, and that's maybe starting to go a little bit the other way, but basically this principle of wise relationship eventually, you know, bore fruit with Russia, with the Soviet Union. They became allies and friends. So do we want to bomb the world with bombs, or do we want to bomb the world with our wise relationship? Which is actually going to make us more secure? So in essence, clarity is seeing the interdependence of things, and then we learn how to relate well inwardly through mindfulness practice, and then we build out from that, recognizing the world of relationships we're embedded within. So what can be very difficult is that we might think that there are people who are not playing very well with relationship. And so part of our inquiry is how can we stay in our own kind of wise, loving heart when we see harm happening around us. But clear seeing shows this. You cannot judge something and understand it at the same time. Mutually exclusive. The minute you start judging, there's no more understanding. Your mind is made up, they're put in a certain box, and that's who they are. We're done gathering data once we start judging. You can't judge and understand at the same time. So we understand if you're upset with what's happening in the country, do you understand it? If you're just judging it, then that's going to get in the way of understanding it. So understanding comes from non-reactive acceptance, accepting curious openness, not having your mind made up. So do you want to oppose people who are aggressive with your own aggression? Or do you want, and so one version of that is, you know, death to all fanatics, right? The fanaticism has turned us fanatical in opposing it. All intolerant people should be shot, right? How do we avoid that? We avoid it through assertiveness. Aggression is some, you know, way to bully people to get our way, whereas assertiveness is to simply rest in our own integrity and our strength and our courage and step forward without in any way disrespecting anyone else. So I kind of want to just go through some principles of really putting our meditation in action. Really, when our actions are informed by our acceptance, our clear seeing, and our emphasis on relationship. So one of the most helpful things for me has been reading the Dalai Lama in this book, Wisdom of Forgiveness. It's actually written by a Chinese person, one of his Chinese friends. And he's just interviewing the Dalai Lama through a lot of the book. And at one point, the Dalai Lama basically says, I don't have a problem forgiving the Chinese. I mean, even though there's been huge atrocities Chinese have committed on Tibet. And he said, it's because I separate actor and action. I'm just paraphrasing. He said, harmful action must be opposed. But I'm not against the actor, because actions change. And the Chinese, one day are my enemy, the next day they could become my friend. So actions are what we struggle with. The things people do is what we think, you know, what we might perceive as harmful. But what we typically do is we confuse someone's actions with who they are. So someone cuts you off in traffic, you know, maybe what they did is dangerous, maybe you got scared, you know, that's all, that happened. But then when you say jerk, that's like a personhood label. You've labeled the person based on an action they did. And so the problem with that is then that person is jerk. And then we're going to run them through the jerk filter, you know, if we were to ever encounter them again. We've already made up our mind. It's a judgment. So if you really want to feel more friendly towards people, and people are always going to mess up and do things wrong, step on our toes, but what can help us feel more friendly is we can oppose harmful action without opposing the person. This is the loving kindness perspective, that there are not enemies out there. We create the enemies by what we make of them in our minds. There are people who do things that are difficult for us, but they're not an enemy until we turn them into that in our mind. And usually when we're confusing actor and action, that person is so rude, so insensitive, so clueless, so this. All of that is defining the person. So that's the first principle of wise action through relationship, is separate actor and action. And then the second principle is, well, who are the actors? Actors are people. Human beings, just like me. And our differences are superficial. What we all have in common is the important stuff. You know, we all want love. We hate having our heart broken. We struggle with the complexity of raising children. We struggle with the busy demands of our life. We don't want to get sick. We don't want to die. Like, that's universally human, and that's the stuff that matters. The other stuff, more superficial. Our differences are superficial. So we have to make a conscious effort to remember humanity. Someone is human. Now, it's very hard when we see someone being aggressive or defensive. Both. It's very hard to see the humanity. So we have to do the active work of remembering it. They are human. It doesn't look like it in this moment because, you know, they're being aggressive or they're being really defensive. But underneath is a heart that's vulnerable and subject to aging and illness and heartbreak and fear and jealousy and shame and hunger. So the second principle is just, you could call it just like me, maybe is the name of the principle. Someone does something to you that hurts you, or you're just like, whoa, who are they? Well, who they really are way down deep is just like me. Doesn't look like it on the surface. And it might not be happening in your interaction, but you can change the dynamic yourself by remembering there's a human being behind the action. So that's the actor. Actors are just like me. So that's the second principle. So the third principle is much easier if the first two are on board. The third principle is let your motivation spring from love and compassion rather than anger and hate. So you might be opposing harmful action. You know, maybe you think somebody is supporting policies that are detrimental to children, you know, let's say in the educational world. So let your energy and your motivation come from your serving children You know, not hating the people that you think are ignorant or wrong, but really remembering, keep your eye on the prize. What are you actually acting for? So we might, if we're acting politically, we need to really focus on, no, I am for, you know, equality or justice. You know, I am for the people that are getting oppressed. And Martin Luther King and the whole civil rights movement was just a huge, huge, amazing example of people acting for, asserting themselves, risking their lives for their own freedom. And Martin Luther King just talking again and again about love, acting from love. It's love that's motivating, loving your enemies even. So kind of a little subset of this is really paying attention to your motivations and try to find a way to be motivated by love and compassion rather than hate and anger. You'll feel better. You can take the same action, but where's it coming from? What's the motivation? So a subset of this is giving up hope and fear. A subset of acting from love. And the way we give up hope and fear, I was Shambhala Center a couple weekends ago, did a weekend on, I forget exactly what it was called, but it was something like going beyond hope and fear in relation to climate change. And I thought right away, wow, that's a pretty good little riddle. How do you face climate change without hope and fear? Not sitting back and just letting it all happen, but actually taking action. How do we take action without hope and fear? So that's a good one, right? Are you scared of what climate change might be already bringing about? Do you have hope for it to change, that it can actually change? This was a huge topic all weekend. How can I give up hope? And one of the, someone stood up and clarified that for them, what they noticed, the difference between optimism and expectation in their hope. So if they had an expectation, it fails them. But to give up optimism also fails them. So they realized that their hope, if it could just be sort of optimistic without attachment or expectation, then for them the hope wasn't the problem. And I thought, kind of works for me. That sounds pretty clear. The facilitator, Peter, am I getting her name right? Meg Wheatley, is that right? Meg Wheatley? Yeah. Yeah? She answered the riddle this way. She said that I start by looking for the basic goodness in people. And once I see the basic goodness, then what to do comes more clearly. But she was kind of saying, until that point, there's a lot of confusion. But once she gets that on board, so just think, you might even consider someone you're in conflict with, you know, some issue going on in your life. What if you could see the basic goodness in the person? You might not like their actions. In fact, the two of you just might not be a good fit. But you still both have basic goodness. There's basically a beating heart in there that has good intentions. So this was Meg's answer to going beyond hope and fear. So with climate change, if we could see the basic goodness in all of us, you know, we might disagree when someone's driving down the road with a gas guzzler. But don't let that let you make that person into your enemy. You don't exactly know why. You might really disagree. But the important thing before you can do anything is to see their basic goodness. That's going to help you go beyond hope and fear. So let me just, I think I have 10 principles. So this is three of them. Separate actor and action. Second one, anyone care to say just to help you remember?
Just like me.
Just like me, right? Remember, we're all fundamentally, in the important ways, the same. And the third one is to, I don't know if I summarize it very simply. Anyone care to?
Interactions come from love and compassion rather than hate and anger.
Perfect, yeah. Let your, really be aware of the motivation for your action. You'll be much happier when you can take the same action from love instead of hate. So, any input? This point, comments, questions. This is hard? There are some people where this would be hard. Yeah. So we can start, the principle in the loving kindness practice that we do in this tradition is you go where it's easy. So you start practicing with easy people. And then when you're in conflict with easy people, then it's easier to remember this. Emphasize the relationship, just like me. Separate actor and action. All of it's easier. So start your practice there. And then you kind of then go towards the more difficult people. But it is a practice. It is absolutely a practice. It's not easy. But we can get better at this. It's kind of fun to get better at this. I'm just going to keep going, unless you have some input. Okay. The fourth principle is never have a point of view. Not. That's not a helpful principle. Of course you will have points of view. We can't really get rid of points of view. But we can recognize that's what they are. I'm not right. I just have a point of view. And this is something our practice can really help us with. Our conceptual mind cannot possibly capture reality. Thinking mind just thinks about reality and tries to conceptualize it. But if I were to hold up an apple or an orange or a tomato, if we did a logical exercise to say, what do you mean when you say tomato? What we would arrive at is it's referring to nothing. That just the simple idea tomato refers to all the green ones, all the ripe ones, all the rotten ones, the tomato flowers that are going to bear the seeds, you know, the leaves and the plant, and then you can't separate that from the soil, water, and air, right? What are we actually referring to? Really what we're referring to is a social construct. We all agree that as long as it has a certain types of characteristics, it's within the set. It's actually a big statistical group, tomato. Remember when they were going to grow square tomatoes? Because you could pack more in a box. And so you actually put a little box around a tomato and it grows into a square tomato. It never really took off, but boy, were they sliced well and put in a grilled cheese. Right? So you could have a square tomato. Now we have purple tomatoes, yellow tomatoes, right? What is a tomato? It's a huge group of things. And we all kind of can agree. It's just, it's a big group. But we all recognize the group, you know? So the conceptual mind can't even capture tomato. What is tomato actually referring to? Nothing. Except a big group agreement. It's a social construct. It's not a reality. So, if we can't get tomato right, then start adding in your own personal history and story and biases and memories, and you start thinking. And then our thinking goes all, I mean, it's all kind of fantasy. And then we have points of view, and then we're convinced that we are right, and they're wrong. And that is the birth. Really, in a way, it's the birth of all violence. Violence comes from deep attachment to view. So the Thai teacher Ajahn Chah said, speech that does not acknowledge uncertainty is not the speech of the sage. Now think about our political discourse. Can you imagine Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton, Gary Johnson, and who's the Green Party, Jill
Stein,
all four of them, and then Ajahn Chah next to them in his ochre robes. And he would say that, and they would all be like, whatever, dude, and boom, they would just keep going. But this is the understanding of conceptual mind. And we need conceptual mind, and it's incredibly useful. But it's limited. We can't. Why do people disagree, and why have people been disagreeing, and why will people always disagree? Because conceptual mind is limited and flawed. It's a loose approximation at best of how things are, and sometimes it's not even that. It's just darn right hallucinogenic. So we will have views, but really notice when you're deeply attached to the rightness of it. Because if you are, I could be very black and white and say, you're wrong, but I won't. I'll just say, it might be partially true. It's certainly true from your point of view, but is it the full truth? No. Conceptual mind doesn't do it. So that's the fourth principle. Let go of attachment to your views. You'll have them. But if you let go of attachment to them, then you can be curious about other people's views and actually learn. So here's a point of view cartoon. Buddhist compliment. I've never met anyone so thoughtless in my life. Right? From our point of view, yeah, that sort of seems like a compliment. Most people not. Here's a, I found this on the internet, so it must be true. It's a cartoon. It's got a bunch of pictures. It's called Libertarians, and then a bunch of captions with smaller pictures. So there's a guy with dreadlocks and a bong, and under it, it says, what Republicans think I do, if I'm a libertarian. And then there's a picture of a really rich guy with his feet up on the desk smoking a cigar, an obvious fat cat. What Democrats think I do, if you're a libertarian. Then they show a bunch of really crazy people protesting, like their eyes popping out of their heads practically, what the media thinks I do. And then this picture, I don't get at all, but there's three people sitting on the living room couch, a dad and two children, with these little cone head hats. What my friends think I do, if I'm a libertarian. And then there's a picture of a revolutionary, U.S. Revolutionary battalion with their fife and drums and marching proudly, you know, for freedom, obviously. What I think I do, the libertarian. And then lastly, what I really do. And there's a guy like this in front of his computer. Points of view. We all have them. We just need to let go of them. Has anyone ever said something like this to you? I understand completely. You like bad movies? I like good movies. Attachment to view. Okay, the fifth principle I've sort of said already, but it's good to have as a standalone. You don't have enemies, you create them. So usually, in a room like this, we're all pretty liberal. But not always. You know, I know some meditators who are pretty conservative. So we never want to assume I'm pretty liberal. My dad's a kind of a moderate Republican. I remember, you know, I was so upset by the election in 2000, being of the liberal point of view, and feeling like it was President-elect Bush instead of President-elect Bush. And I literally had in my mind, when I was doing loving kindness practice, I could not send metta towards the right, which included my dad, because I felt it was so wrong. And what I realized in my practice was that was a very insecure place for me, where literally I was picturing half the country as crazy, stupid, with bad intentions. And that was a scary place to live. They weren't humans anymore. They were my enemy. And it was doing metta, loving kindness practice, which made me realize I was doing that. And then I had my dad as somebody who's super intelligent and super well-educated, and oh boy, getting in a political argument with him, you know, you're going to feel like mincemeat pretty quickly. And he doesn't do it aggressively. He's just so freaking smart about it. So well-informed. He has a memory like a steel trap. So sometimes I have to resort to, well, Dad, I know experts who could refute your argument, you know, because, you know, we literally argued once about that oil companies get a lot of subsidies. And he just, you know, had eight little points why that wasn't true. And I said, well, I've heard experts refute all of those, but I can't. He's like, well, I've got experts that'll refute your experts. So, the point is this, though. We actually feel much safer and secure in our hearts if we don't have half the world as our enemy. So if you're assuming that right now in the people you disagree with are either crazy or ignorant or malintended, how's that working for you? And you might want to actually ask yourself if that's really true. And then you might have the question come in right away, I don't want to go there because I need to fight and I need to oppose and I need to take action. Well, what if you could take that action and be just as active but without the hate and without the fear and without the assumption that people are idiots or crazy. Again, if we go back to actor and action, what if you could remember that these are people? I just happen to really see things so differently. But that's because of my history, my values, my assumptions, my projections, my points of view. Might I actually be willing to listen? Don't do it for them, do it for you. Because when I had that understanding back in 2000, I realized I felt much better if I didn't make those assumptions. If I just said, wow, I really disagree. Period. So what gets in the way of that? And what gets in the way of really all of this? So this is the sixth principle which we've been putting into action. Your difficulty with other people is the difficult emotions that get stimulated inside of you when you're with them or think about them. So the difficulty really is here. What's closer to home is not them out there. It's what gets evoked in us. Fear, anger, hate, irritation, jealousy. So the reason our focus today is in part in working with emotions is, oh, if we can actually wake up to our emotional life, our difficult emotions, then we can actually be much braver in taking action because we're not so freaked out about avoiding this or that so that we don't have to feel something hard. This is a huge way our practice informs our action. The difficult interaction with your kid, with your coworker, with your partner. All of it becomes easier when you know you can be with fear, you can be with sadness, etc. We actually often make judgments of other people as a way of protecting. We don't want to feel the hurt, the vulnerability, the helplessness, the whatever it is underneath. So we just judge the crap out of people as the defense against our own feelings. When you really can't separate actor and action, you just think someone's a real total jerk. It might be because there's something got evoked inside so vulnerable that it's really hard for you to face it. And so you project out this judgment. So judgment is often a kind of protection. So it's really more about us than them. And even if we can't open to what is threatening inside, we can at least recognize what we're doing. So there's a couple more I can move through more quickly, and then I'll spend a little time on the last one. Pay attention to how your media consumption affects you. I don't own a TV, but when I visit my parents, TV is on all the time. My parents are divorced, but they're both political junkies. They're watching CNN all day long. And I just can't take it after a while because it's so much information about such little nuances in, you know, really the horse race right now, right? They're not even covering necessarily substantive issues or policies. It's just a whole lot about little nuances. And it's on all the time. And if you're a person who's doing a lot of media consumption, you might just experiment with taking a day or two off and just see what happens. Because it can condition a lot of fear and a lot of anger. And so that then that obviously we need it to be informed, but how much do you need? We don't pay conscious attention to that. This is a big, huge one, but I'll just say it briefly. Then make a difference in your own way. Everything we do that's putting constructive, wholesome energy into the world helps, because it's all interrelated. And when we're generous and we're kind and we're giving of our energy and we're, you know, making sacrifices, doing things we don't want to do for others, we are helping. And so the more you can see that your life as it is, you know, is somehow helping. It's an attempt to move us in the right direction, then you feel much better because you're making a difference that you can see. It's local. You're acting locally. And we have all these global problems. And, you know, sure, we might really want to take action around those. I mean, we're at war. So that's one global thing we don't want to ignore. But we burn out less. We feel better. We feel more optimistic when we take action in our world. And then, so the last one, as we talked about, let go of attachment to view. The last one is let go of attachment to result. We must act, and we must act impeccably and in our integrity. But we suffer when we take responsibility for the result. And again, this is about getting your kid to do his or her, or if they're not on the gender binary, their homework. Or this is, you know, opposing politics right now. We can only do what we can do. And we can really only do what we're willing to do. There's some things we can do, we're just not willing. So we do what we're willing to do and we let go. And then we might have to act 3 seconds later and we do it again. And then we let go. The Tao Te Ching says, do your work, then step back. The only path to serenity. So you can just keep asking yourself, is there anything I'm willing to do? And if there is, do it. But if there's not, you're done for that moment. You're done. Let go. There's nothing you're willing to do, so accept it. It is what it is. So. I'll stop, invite your input. How you doing with all this?
I mean, I think a lot of people might see people who do this kind of work as sort of wishy-washy, like you never take a real strong point of view.
The people who do climate change work?
No, the people who are outside, you know, people who judge airy-fairy meditators.
Oh, okay. Sounds like a judgment. The airy-fairy meditators.
How do you reconcile something like, you know, going to a climate change conference, you definitely have a point of view about it, but you're open to other points of view. How open to other points of view are you? I mean...
You're talking about me personally?
Well, yeah, okay, you personally.
Or?
Yeah, you.
Well, with climate change...
Yeah, how do you deal with that issue?
Having been a former scientist, having talked to geophysicists, climatologists, anyone you talk to, say the science is rock solid.
So
in that case, I'm willing to believe the people who are the experts, and trying to get a scientific consensus on anything, I think the American Geophysical Union is something like 98% of its members believe in humans are causing climate change. I personally am totally willing to defer to that. And so, could they be wrong? Well, maybe. But I think there's more agreement there than possibly among about evolution. You know, I mean, this is, people are, I mean, I don't want to overstate that, but, you know, there's tremendous consensus among the experts. And again, my understanding is the media gives, again, this is my point of view, undue attention to the naysayers. Within the scientific world, it's not really there.
So what you're saying is that there's a scientific point of view that's more valid than some guy who doesn't believe in
it. Absolutely. Yeah. It's not right, it's just more valid. Does 2 + 2 = 5 or 8 or 4? They're all constructs.
That kind of answers the question as you look to science as kind of a bedrock of opinion, or point of view.
Definitely. Do thoughts capture reality? No. Are some thoughts more aligned with reality than others? Absolutely.
That's your point of view.
And I'm willing to take that risk. 2 + 2 does not equal 5. 2 + 2 = 4.
I'm just trying to look at it. Is there a place to stand?
In?
Anything. I mean, if you take the attitude that we all have a point of view, and all points, I guess all points of view aren't, I would judge that not all points of view are valid.
Right. The scientific approach never asserts a point of view. It rejects all points of view, and then the only one remaining standing is the one that you fail to reject. I mean, that's literally the way scientists hold their views. You can't really assert a view, you can only fail to reject. But the fail to reject one got us to the moon, you know, got the you know, satellites out to the Kuiper Belt, or maybe they're headed that way. It's headed that way, right? I mean, the fail to reject is very powerful. The one left standing is the one we can put our energy behind. But it doesn't mean it's right. But we have to. We can take action based on a point of view. Understanding that it's a point of view. Because we know, all know this with medicine, right? They just keep, you know, carbs, everyone used to say, like, stay away from the fats, right? Now the science has changed, and now fats are good. Fats help you lose weight, right? That changed. So scientific views are always up for change, but that's what's great about science, is it's built into the process. We just fail to reject. But we need to take action. We have to decide what to eat. So,
yeah. That's what I was getting at. It just seems like there is not all, I don't think all points of view are necessarily equal.
Right.
And I would say that's probably based on some.
Yeah. Or some people might say logic, or some people might say personal experience. This is what works in relationships. I mean, there's.
It's an interesting. I really like that. Even with the science where you're talking about optimism without expectation, it's like you come up with an answer that you don't know what the outcome will be. Which is weird. But I'm curious about taking action in more of like the social.
Yeah.
Like, how do we judge what is more valid? Like, I've just been reading Between the World and by Ta-Nehisi Coates, so it's this letter to his son about racism. He wanted to
know
about.
Yeah.
And
what's the name of the book again?
Between the World and Me.
Okay. Yeah.
Recounting the one thing that I'm interested in is how do you take stands on social situations such as racism, such as, and determine the validity of that point of view, you know? Does that make sense? And then I'm
Right. Well, I mean, again, we don't want to get too academic here, like what is racism, or, but we might want to listen to the people who are saying they feel oppressed by racial views in this country. It's like, if we're a privileged white male, we don't necessarily know what oppression is like. We might, because through other things, but we have to find a way to know what oppression is like in our own experience to be able to relate to what other people are saying. Yeah, it's a big thorny issue, but we need to really use our intelligence and our empathy in navigating, and then we need to really look inside. Mindfulness will show us that we, as white people, we all look pretty white in this room. We're racist. You are not a racist. That didn't mean to say that. I am not a racist. But we have racist thoughts. We will see racist thoughts pass through our heads because we are conditioned. We've been conditioned. We will assign group characteristics to an individual, the definition of bigotry, right? We see a person and we make assumptions about them because of their race. That's bigotry. And we do that in all kinds of ways. So part of the inquiry is watching our own experience. And it isn't just out there. But, you know, a lot of it in the diversity work that I've done, a lot of it is white people getting together and talking about it, talking about our privilege and our assumptions. Like the things we can do, like, you know, none of us has been pulled over for driving while black, right? That's the white privilege. And so, I mean, a lot of this is education and intelligence and care.